And when I get excited, my little disclaimer, she says, oh baby, the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. You're listening to Ancast, counting all the best to the 80s, 90s, and now. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. This is part two of our 1980s show, which you are joining already in progress. This will be counting down our number five through number one, and joining me for this is Justin Tsevakis, otakuusa.com, and animeworldorder.com's Daryl Surratt, and an animator and the man behind starblazers.com, Tim Eldred. So we're gonna just jump right in, and if you didn't hear part one, well, go back and listen to it. What's wrong with you? Okay, all right, so that means we're ready for number five. And on that, let's start with Justin.
Okay. My number five is actually one that I wrote a huge essay about ages ago, but I haven't talked about much since. That is Megazone 2-3 Part 2.
All right.
Ooh.
Now, there are fans that love Part 1 and hate Part 2, and there are fans that love Part 2 and hate Part 1, and I am decidedly one of the latter.
Uh-huh.
Part 1, as has been discussed, was actually kind of a bailout. What happened was Ishiguro-san was planning it as this big expansive TV series. Then their sponsor pulled out and they were stuck with all this pre-production that they had spent months and maybe a year on, and they didn't have anything to do with it, so they just kind of cut their losses and made it into an OVA. The second OVA was way more nihilistic, way more destructive, and had a really interesting political message, basically for the youth, that, you know, basically crystallizes, you know, the whole, you know, adults are evil sort of thing, but you don't have to become one of them if you don't want to. And I thought that was a really interesting message, and also this has some really, really, really great artwork from Yasuo Miyametsu. Who, you know,
is he the character designer?
Yeah, he's the character designer and also the animation director. And that he has this horrible habit of biting off way more than he can chew, especially back then. So these characters look ridiculously well detailed, especially for the era. I mean, these meticulously wrinkled, animated, detailed sex wax jackets, which if you weren't alive in the 80s, that was a big thing. These just ridiculously detailed costumes, probably one of the most centrally animated sex scenes in anime history, which is saying quite a lot.
He seems to do that often.
Yeah, he does that. Hey, this one is free of rape and giant monstrous guys, so I appreciate that. but it just aesthetically, I love this OVA. Now, they were clearly having some deadline and budgetary issues towards the end of production, so there are some scenes that really look janky. But I don't know. For some reason, I don't see that necessarily as a minus, but also more as kind of evidence of how hard people worked on it.
One of the joys of anime, especially in the 70s and early 80s, is when you can see that human touch, which has kind of been synthesized out by computers since then. And the result is you really get the sense that this was made by human beings and not machines.
Yeah, you really do. And, you know, the thing is, this also had the other great music, pop music plays while stuff in space blows up sequence from the 80s. You know, the other being Do You Remember Love? This is the other one. And I don't know. I was able to personalize this one a lot more. And, this is one of those shows that's just been a part of me ever since.
I think you're onto something there, Justin. I think the schism between the preference of two over one, I found that a lot of people who were teenagers in the 80s who were into punk music and all that stuff, they really gravitate way more towards this movie than part one. And I didn't you know, I wasn't a teenager growing up in the, at the time. I didn't really follow the scene, as it were. But as far as like the attitude and the worldview and what these people are dressed up like and what they're fighting up against, that really, you know, ties into that whole punk aesthetic or, you know, mindset, I should say, of the time. I was just winding up to say, like, I think really that's why so many people like this one. And, you know, the first one, it doesn't really have that, you know, eat hot lead fascist pig, you know, mentality that this one's got.
Right. I mean, the first one was so happy. And I don't think that happiness jibes with its story. It's a melancholy, you know, I've been lied to my entire life premise. And to have that much joy and bright colors and stupid stuff going on, I think kind of does a disservice to that premise.
Yeah, I watched these as part of my list. And it is my understanding that the third one is not worth watching, right?
Oh, we made some observations about the third one on our own podcast. Yeah, that one is legendarily poor.
Okay. Yeah, it might as well not even exist as far as I'm concerned.
But I thought that the first two had really, really neat ideas in them. Really cool science fiction concept. And a matter of fact, like going through all this stuff, I had consumed more science fiction in the last 2 weeks than I think maybe in my entire life combined. There's a lot of sci-fi in the 80s.
Yeah, I think that's why people often refer to the 80s as the golden age of sci-fi anime.
Yeah,
just because it seemed like so much of it was that, and that was like the Fred Patton ideal of why people started to turn to anime. Like, they were sci-fi fans who found, like, oh, there's all this new sci-fi in the realm of Japanese animation. And, you know, of course, over the years, that sort of dwindled down significantly.
It didn't make it onto my list, but, yeah, definitely some really, really cool ideas and very interesting interesting execution. The stark visual differences between the first and the second one, I mean, you basically have to pick one. You can't just say, like, oh, I like both of these equally. You kind of have to decide, like, okay, do I like the first one better or the second one better? And I think, Justin, knowing your sensibilities, it doesn't surprise me at all that the second one is more your speed.
I like things dark.
Yeah. Okay, so we will probably, I imagine that one will be brought up later, but Tim, let's go with your number five.
My number five is a twofer. It is Mobile Suit Zeta Gundam and the follow-up Double Zeta.
Double Zeta is an interesting pick.
I'm still amazed at how divided fandom is over that. It's like the redheaded stepchild of the Gundam universe. Also, I should probably mention going in that I did not include the first series because the bulk of it was broadcast in 1979. And for that reason and that reason alone, it is not part of my 1980s lineup. But Zeta Gundam was still on the air when I first learned about it, which gave it this sort of extra magical quality because I was finally able to see something kind of close to real time. And I didn't understand a word of it back then because the story is extremely dense and most of it is carried through dialogue as opposed to visuals. And so it took many years to kind of untangle that story and several viewings, some with Hong Kong subtitles that were barely there, and then the first round of Bandai subtitles, and then finally the second round of Bandai subtitles and various other things here and there. So it's a story that takes a while to open up. If you started watching it back then, if you pick it up now, it's less special.
What was it about it that made you want to exert like that much more effort to really get to the bottom of this one?
I think it was the overall production value because the art was a step above the normal TV standard that I'd seen at the time. Giant Gorg being the exception. But then again, these character designs were also by Yasuhiko, so that was already an access point for me. And I could tell that just based on the amount of work that had been put into the production design, that there was probably the same level of care given to the writing. And over time, that proved to be correct. It's getting kind of stylish to bash it now, but I think that's more to do with having seen so many other things like it and not getting it in the order of production. But in 1985, it was the shit. It was the big thing. Everybody loved it, including me. And it has a very serious overtone that vanishes instantly as soon as you shift it over to Double Zeta, which is almost a comedy. Some people are tempted to call it that, but it's more a tonal shift having to do with moving one set of characters aside and then bringing in another set of characters with different concerns and a different worldview that lightens the touch. And I think it's a really good balancing act. I've never watched Zeta without also continuing on to Double Zeta, because there's a very strong continuity. You go immediately from the last episode of the first to the first episode of the new one, and it picks right up. And then it comes back around in the second half to become a more serious show again. In some ways, I like Double Zeta a little better because it dares to be humorous. It doesn't take itself too seriously. But it inherits a gigantic weight of gravitas from Zeta that keeps it on the straight and narrow, keeps it from going too far off into its own self-reverential wacky land.
I think that's why it's the redheaded stepchild of all the Universal Century Gundam shows, that it's the only one to adopt that tone. And particularly, you know, I understand it's intentional coming off of Zeta Gundam, but, you know, to go from that ending to what is effectively Scooby-Doo seems kind of a jarring. And then the few returning villains and such from the previous ones who were particularly menacing and vile are now, you know, jokes. They're Dick Dastardly, you know, almost.
Their circumstances are drastically reduced, which plays up some of the humor and removes, I think, some of the weight that they earned toward the end of Zeta, which is hyper serious. It is Shakespeare times 10. And it takes 45 episodes to build up to it, and it's worth every minute. But you're exactly right. Stylistically, it may not have been the best choice to go from that level of drama and tension to something that is a comedy by comparison. But there's just something that kept me hooked on it, and I think it was just that the characters were fun to watch. And it was a relief valve after all the mega death that had preceded it. And to this day, Judo Ashita is still my favorite character of the UC Gundam continuity. I wish he would come back. There was an opportunity, I think, that was lost in Shaw's counterattack to bring him back and make him part of the story again. And it would have had the same effect. It would have introduced a different voice. And it would have kept the thing from taking itself so seriously, which I think may be one of the reasons people are turned off from it now. We're living in an age when anime doesn't take itself that seriously anymore. And so something that is serious and is earnest for 50 episodes and it's unrelenting does kind of turn itself into parody after a while.
I think another thing to go into like the legacy of Double Zeta, I mean, I'm not a fan of the Zeta Gundam compilation movies just because like that story is so dense, there really isn't much to cut out and leave a coherent narrative the way there was for the original Mobile Suit Gundam. But in addition, the changes to the storyline effectively make it such that Double Zeta Gundam more or less never happened.
Yeah, it gets erased. And that was unfortunate. I was looking forward to Double Zeta movies, but I kind of knew they were going to give it the heave-ho because it's never gotten much love from Bandai.
Yep. All right. Cool. I don't know if I'll ever get around to Zeta Gundam, but it is definitely controversial.
I was just on another podcast with a fan who had never seen Double Zeta, and so they took it upon themselves to watch through it. That's Scott Spaziani over at Otaku and Review, and he did not have a good time with Double Zeta Gundam at all. He was just because of not only the additional lightheartedness and tone, but also the fact that, you know, partway through they semi-realize, okay, we've got another movie to build to, and we have to make it a little more serious. There's no cut and paste. There's no cut point where you say, okay, from this point on, it's serious. There's just a couple more serious episodes and then a couple more lighthearted ones. And, you know, the schizophrenic tonal shift, you know, made it hard for him to keep in the game. And I don't blame him. Very few people I know, even the diehard Gundam fans, can make it through Double Zeta. And that's probably why it's one of the only ones, you know, until recently anyway, that just never came out here.
Mm-hmm. It's an acquired taste. I fully admit that.
Okay. All right. So that brings us to Daryl. You're number five.
All right. On the subject of acquired tastes, I'm not really sure if anyone else would be mentioning this one because it is a Rintaro work. You know, we did previously mention Ado Galaxy Express, but as far as being a divisive guy, Rintaro is it. My number five, don't expect anyone else to like this one, but it's The Dagger of Kamui, the feature film from, I believe, 1985. It's a very long sort of epic, literally epic, not like the way people use epic, you know, in common parlance today. A ninja tale, you know, set in, you know, feudal Japan. It's really, really innovative in terms of its visuals, in terms of its soundtrack. There's nothing else, you know, before or since that looks the way this movie does. There's with one exception, I can think of basically nothing else that sounds the way this movie does. It certainly is not, you know, I guess because it's compiled from a series of novels, you know, some people say it's a little too long, a little too meandering. I like the fact that, you know, what starts off as a somewhat simple tale ends up spanning the world. There's a lot of characters who show up. It's a historical fiction, so a lot of historical characters make appearances. The most reductive way that everyone always sums this movie up as is it's the movie where Mark Twain shows up. And that certainly happens. And but I just think that's unfair to, you know, summarize this movie as that's the only thing of note that this movie has to offer. You might just be in nostalgia blinders on. This is perhaps the second subtitled anime I saw in my entire life. You know, rented it from the video store just because, you know, people said, hey, you seen this movie? It's pretty cool. But yeah, this is definitely a unique one. It's $8 on DVD, but the US DVD is, you know, not the best as far as presentation wise for the film. There's been a really good remastered Japanese edition that I'd like to get my hands on someday. But yeah, in terms of just a sprawling story with a lot of really unique cinematography and crazy ninja fights, this is a great, great movie. And I do encourage it that people check it out. But since it's Rintaro, you're either going to love it or really hate it.
Yeah, this is the Rintaro. This and Harmageddon are the Rintaro poster children for really, really amazing, spectacular animation that, in my opinion, just does not connect with the story and in some cases works directly against it.
Yeah, I actually love this movie and don't like Harmageddon. So that's the divisive nature of Rintaro. You flip a coin, he either does like a great movie or a horrible one, and no one agrees on which ones his great movies and which ones are his horrible movies.
It is true.
You're going to have to turn in your Patrick Macias approval badge for that.
Oh, we had Patrick on when we reviewed Harmageddon, and Gerald actually likes Harmageddon more than Patrick, which he didn't think was possible.
I would like to back up everything you said about Dagger of Kamui. Even though it's not on my top 10, I still have a lot of respect for it. My friends and I saw it the same time as Nausicaa. I believe they both came in together from a single tape trading source, and we were astonished by the love of movement that was shown from beginning to end in that film. It was almost like an experimental film where they just decided, we're going to have something move in every frame. There is never going to be a still frame in this film. Something will always be moving, even if it's just an environmental effect. And it's a very expensive way to do things, but I don't think it's ever been done again. I think it's, for that reason alone, it's interesting just to look at in terms of the craft of animation.
One of those I've always meant to see and never have and didn't get to for this either. So,
well, it's a movie that's about 2 hours and 15 minutes long, so if you're under a time crunch, I can understand.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Also, I saw Rintaro's name and said, well, maybe next time or something, I don't know. Okay, so that's brings us to my number five. My number five is a cheat. Sorry, I totally cheated. It's two movies. It is the two, I think, Ghibli films that are the best of their children's, their animated efforts that are, you know, aimed at children and for a child audience, but resonate among adults. It's Kiki's Delivery
Brave
Service.
Of the Five.
Only Yesterday. That's where I'm going with this. Kiki's Delivery Service and My Neighbor Totoro are my number five. I was just going to put Totoro, but I think Kiki's it's not as successful in terms of just being a really, really great family film, but it's almost as successful. And the quiet moments in Kiki's Delivery Service are really just absolutely gorgeous. It's not as you know, quickly paced. It's longer than Totoro is by about 10, 15 minutes, I think. But both of these represent when Ghibli is doing their absolute best work for a family audience, as opposed to something like, you know, Princess Mononoke, which is definitely, you know, could be seen as sort of a family thing, but it's harder edged. It's got a lot more to say. Kiki and Totoro are both, at the peak of their powers, producing four children. And they're both great movies for, you know, adults and children. But, they had to be in here somewhere. And I wanted to throw them in there and give them their own place. I haven't seen Kiki's in, probably 3 or 4 years. I need to revisit it. But my memories of it are very strong. So I don't know. Anybody else have a take on these?
It was hard for me to pick one. I was trying to pick just the one. Ghibli one, because I didn't want my top 10 to just be laden with stuff from the same person. So I was like, let me leave it to one. And, Kiki's Delivery Service and My Neighbor Totoro are both, you know, really, really well renowned, especially Totoro. I think that the thing about Kiki is that it's like it's the Europe that you always wanted to visit. That's like the real like appeal of the movie. It was interesting that Disney chose to release that as like their first one, as part of the deal, back when, this is years ago at this point. But fascinatingly enough, I could never, like when I try to show the movie to people, who are like newer anime fans, they wouldn't really be all that interested in either of them, which, maybe that's part of why so much of me died, back in my college days. It's like, what do you mean you guys don't like My Neighbor Totoro? You can't, you know, pay attention to Kiki. It's like, maybe I just fell in with the wrong crowd.
I think not great liking, movies. Not liking My Neighbor Totoro is a sign of an empty soul. What is wrong with you? Like, how can you not like that movie?
They just like, you know, people would get fidgety or not really pay attention, or, you know, I don't get it. It's like, these are movies for kids who are fidgety and ADD, you know, sort of people, and it's meant to just draw them in and does such a good job, both of them.
Well, it's also meant to remind you what it was like to be a kid.
Yeah.
And so if you're a kid watching it, so, you know.
Yeah, when there was an element of magic in everything and you didn't understand how the world worked yet, and there was still room for fantasy and reality to mix. And I think if you have if you've forgotten what that's like, this movie is made to remind you of that.
Yeah, you know, including them on here, I put them on there. Before I even, you know, the first thing that came to mind was, hey, we're going to do a list of the top anime of the 80s. It's like, okay, well, I have to put Kiki and Totoro on there. And initially I was like, oh, am I just doing this because it's obligatory? And it's like, no, these are obligatory because they're absolutely essential. Like, you can't not see these. They're quintessential titles in the Ghibli catalog, Totoro obviously being the biggest one. Something that they've been hanging their merchandise hat on for the last 25 years or so. But yeah, I mean, they belong anywhere. If you haven't seen them and you like anime, Jesus, stop what you're doing right now and go watch them.
You'll be surprised how year after year I encounter people who have not seen hardly any of the Studio Ghibli catalog. I will say I've never successfully managed to show any one person like, okay, here's the Ghibli movies. They never quite make it through all of them. There's just, I don't know, there's a different set of interests as far as who these movies are for versus who a lot of, the anime that's current, I guess, is for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all right. User lists for number five. Shinmaru has another cheater, Rose of Versailles, Macross, Akira. All right. Bugram has Irisyatsura, City Hunter. Interesting pick. And Area 88, the OVA.
Which, I like City Hunter, but man, a little bit of it goes a long way. It's very repetitive.
Yeah. What, him getting hit in the head with a hammer on episode 78 isn't still funny? Like,
thank you, Justin. I was trying to figure out why it didn't make my top 10, and you just put it on a plate for me.
Yeah. And Cowboy Dev, man, a lot of people cheating Rose of Versailles. You guys are cheaters. Cowboy Dev, number one. Yuri Seatsura, number two. Rose of Versailles, number three. Legend of Galactic Heroes. Okay. Actually, going through this, I found that picking stuff that started in the late 70s and ended in the 80s and started in the late 80s and ended in the early 90s was, how do you pick that? You know, what do you do with that?
I think it has to do with what informed the source material. Rose of Versailles obviously started in the 70s because we had the manga first. And so I think by definition, that's a 70s story.
It looks very 70s.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
No denying that. Okay. All right, so we are on our number fours. And this time, let's start with Tim.
Number four for me is already come up once. Fist of the North Star.
Okay.
And specifically the TV series. I like the movie a lot, but there's just so much more in the series. And it's so much fun to watch. And it does a great job of bouncing between the utterly ridiculous and the utterly sublime. So it's a full course meal. Daryl already hit on most of the good points, so I'm just going to say what I personally like about it. And that is that it doesn't forget what it is. It doesn't try to reinvent itself until it gives way to Fist in the North Star 2, which is why that didn't make my top 10. And it's also not afraid to be sentimental. You can go through this broad spectrum within just pick any 10 episodes where you will find one that is so over the top you wonder how anybody ever approved it, and then another one that will just break your heart. And not for the wrong reasons, not because you're looking at a postcard of a sunset, but you're looking at a real sunset. And it's also one of those shows that I think really tests your endurance because it doesn't get really good until you get about up to episode 20. And it doesn't get really, really good until you get up into the 30s. And it doesn't get really, really, really good until you get up into the 60s. And it doesn't get mind-blowingly good until you get up in the 90s. But what
I think to kind of contextualize that, there's a lot of people like today who have a really hard time going back and watching Rurouni Kenshin. And the reason for that is because a lot of the silly, you know, we'll call them filler episodes because they weren't stories from the manga. They're all sort of front loaded at the beginning. And that doesn't really kick in until, you know, the late teens, early 20s. A lot of people, when they wonder like, why Fist of the North Star? What's like the magic of this one? It's because a lot of those early episodes were, like you said, silly and goofy, and like it doesn't like really start to hit its stride until those points you just mentioned. And a lot of people, it's like, that's a whole series you're asking me to watch. I mean, a typical TV show now, 13 episodes long, at least with Fist of the North Star, the way it's set up, you can just skip to the good parts if you're feeling, you know, the need to, because it's a pretty insurmountable task to watch through that show. It's not short.
Yeah, and there's definitely enough information about it out there so that you can figure out what the good parts are, and I put quotes around that, and then just jump to those if you really don't want to spend the time. But to anyone who's inclined to do that, I would say that if you take the time to watch all of them in order as intended, there are built-in rewards for doing that. And you are in a much better position to appreciate those rewards if you put in the effort. And in that way, it becomes kind of a microcosm of anime in general, at least the anime that I experienced in the 80s growing up and collecting it, which was the enjoyment that you got out of it was directly reciprocal to the effort you put into it. And Fist of the North Star encapsulates that in a single show. Like I said, it doesn't get mind-blowingly good until you get up into the 90s, but there are rewards for enduring it all the way up to that point. And then the rewards just come many times over as you go into the final arc. And for that reason, it is a permanent member of my top 10.
Cool. I just want to point out that the actual horrible filler bullshit in Rurouni Kenshin is basically seasons three. And,
that's what killed the show afterwards, right?
Yeah. The
but there's also a good chunk right at the beginning.
Yeah, the first season isn't great, and the third season, it's really bad.
Awful.
Okay, so that will bring us then to Daryl, your number four.
All right. You know it had to come up at some point. My number four is Akira. The film specifically, I mean, certainly the manga I didn't get to read till many years later, but this is for so many people, the iconic image of what not just anime of the 1980s is, but for a long time, what anime period was. And, as far as having a representative, ambassador for anime, this is, I'm pretty good with Akira being the one, phenomenal animation on a technical level, which, you know, has basically not been, you know, matched since in the way that they produced this film anyway. Soundtrack, you know, again, the only other film when I said there was no other movie that sounded similar to The Dagger of Kamui, save for one, Akira is the other one. They both use a very strange set of musical instruments and chants and such that you don't typically hear from in film or animation alike. The story certainly is gigantic and compressed down to fit into one film, but I don't think you could have done a better job. I mean, it's a virtually impossible task, but it's, you know, written by, directed by, you know, storyboards, etc., by the same guy who wrote the manga, Katsuhiro Otomo. This is still, by far and away, his best work. You know, he's tried to recapture the magic since, and it, you know, can't really, you know, be done. But when you write one as good as this one, you know, I'll cut him some slack for it. I think a lot of the reputation this movie has as being a movie that makes no sense, once again, was the original English localization of it, which, don't get me wrong, I love the voice acting cast that they got, but the script makes it very difficult to understand, you know, what's going on, why are these people doing this, and so on and so forth. But it's definitely one for your Blu-ray collection. I think it's something that everybody needs to see. It still holds up, and thankfully we've got the full manga in English now for people to go and read afterwards. So yeah, it's like Akira is, you know, transcendental at this point as far as 80s anime. You know, great pick.
It says something about how bad that dub really is when I remember renting the Criterion Laserdisc, and only when watching it in raw Japanese did I really feel like I understood it.
How many times has that been dubbed? Just twice or more?
Just twice.
Two times. Although I will say I would, you know, just for pure nostalgia's sake, like to have a U.S., like official U.S. release that had both audio tracks on it.
That would be nice.
I mean, fans have made their own, you know, versions where you can get, you know, the old audio synced up to the Blu-ray video, but I'd like a, you know, one that I can buy.
Yeah, I struggled with why I didn't get this into my top 10 as well. I think if we went to 15 or maybe a dozen, it would have gotten in. But I think what's keeping it off is just that it's not as repeatable as some of my other choices, in my opinion. Movies in general are less repeatable than TV shows because there's just less of them. But if you haven't seen it, it's got to be on your bucket list. Or otherwise, you cannot seriously call yourself an anime fan.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, so Justin, you're number four.
My number four is mildly obscure. It is also a kid's film that no kid will ever fully understand. Night on the Galactic Railroad.
Yeah. Yep, that's the guess. I thought that was going to be your number one, honestly.
That's also my number four, so we can plow through this one.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. God, is this movie gorgeous. This is a really, really hard book to adapt into any theatrical or movie setting, simply because the book was not finished. The Japanese versions were constructed from four different working drafts that were discovered posthumously. So this adaptation was actually adapted by a famous Japanese playwright, and they decided to make them cats because it made them it made them more relatable and less specific. Like, the characters are so kind of – it's such an ethereal story that if you over-specify where it takes place, who it takes place to, it loses something. And as a result, a lot of American fans can't get past the fact that every character is a cat.
Well, I actually, you know, that's fascinating. I'll defer to your authority on this film in particular, but I actually, when I watched the film, I always thought the choice to make them anthropomorphic cats was to juxtapose them from the actual human beings that they encounter later on.
Well, they went through several drafts of this. Like, this is actually a little bit of a tortured production because they just couldn't make it work with all human characters. And that's why so many of the following productions, including both Kenji's Spring, Spring and Chaos, and the that new one, Gusco Bodori, follows suit with the whole cat thing. And they got the idea because some illustrator made a manga version with cats, and they're like, oh, wow, this really works.
I'm just absolutely floored that we're even getting a Gusco Bodori no Denki. Like, I'm glad that it's getting made, but... You know, it's such a, you know, prestige sort of artistic sort of project. Like Zach was saying, why you had Angel's Egg on there, to see something like that be made in the modern day is great, and I can't wait to see it.
I've been eagerly anticipating it since it was announced like 3 years ago, and I was really worried because it really looked like it wasn't going to get finished at one point. But this film is just kind of this ethereal, moody, dark magic. It creeps up on you. It's a movie to watch like alone in a really dark room on a really dark, quiet night, and just kind of it's almost a ghost story, like in the sense that it's suspenseful like a ghost story, but it's so quiet and edgy and just off. And it's so hard for me to think of this in the context of it being children's literature.
Yeah, that was my major connection with it, is the execution. I think as a piece of art cinema, it is wildly successful in what it's trying to do. And the imagery in it is second to none. It is gorgeous. I love some of the set pieces in that thing. They're sort of burned into my head. And the first time I saw it, I just sat there thinking, like, I'm kind of glad I didn't see it until I was a good ways into adulthood. I feel like I appreciate it more now, being into what I'm into and liking what I like, and it appeals to my sensibilities much more now than it would have even 10 years ago. But it's a really successful piece of art film. It's really, really good. I frankly, like, the cats add to the surreality, the surrealism of it all in an extremely effective way. It is a really, really effective way to tell that story. It's a really great creative decision. I mean, I can't imagine it without those cats at this point. But yeah. No, it's fantastic, fantastic stuff.
God, that soundtrack is just indelible.
Yeah, it's
you
great.
Know.
Yeah, perfect.
Is there a good translation in English of the original novel? I always heard that the localizations were not up to par.
Just the Stonebridge Press one is a little janky. Apparently, the newer printings, they corrected that horribly awful, arrogant mistake where they Japanesized the names for some reason. The names, all the cast names are Italian, and there's a lot of references to Esperanto. So it's meant to be a kind of nebulously Western story, but yeah, they for some reason they Japanesized them in the Stonebridge Press version. There's a couple other good ones, and you'll have to like get a Kodansha import, but some of them are actually fairly cheap.
Okay, cool. So that's two Trains in Space films making the top 10 rounds.
Well, one definitely came from the other, so.
Yep, undeniably.
Okay. All right. Well, since that covers my number four as well, we can get to the user lists. All right. Zaku Ace, his number one, Area 88. Number two, Bubblegum Crisis. Haven't heard that one come up yet. And with good cause. Number three, Riding Bean. So, yeah. First mention of BGC.
I still love Bubblegum Crisis even to this day. It's not on my top 10 list just because, you know, if I had waited 5 minutes, I would have written another list. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that no one really cares about anymore. I understand why, but that's, again, like Tim was saying with Zeta Gundam for 84, 85 as being the hot show that everybody at the time really loved. That was what Bubblegum Crisis was for, you know, 1989 to, you know, 1991 or 92.
Yeah.
That was what everybody talked about. You know, got its own separate, you know, place to talk about that, separate from all the rest of the anime, because people were just nonstop into Bubblegum Crisis. I still like the show. It was, you know, a nostalgic sort of childhood thing. But yeah, I wouldn't make other people watch it today, especially not on Hulu where it's streaming, because that's the dub of Bubblegum Crisis, which is one of the most notoriously. One of the most notoriously awful English dubs ever made. Probably a lot of the same people responsible for that Riding Bean dub.
And the
and they share some staff. Yeah, yes, that's right. Those obnoxious aliens specifically, not the British one.
Right.
But yeah, I still enjoy Bubblegum Crisis. But yeah, I wrote an article on it for the Otaku USA website, which kind of sums up my feelings on it in 2011, 2012. So I'll leave it at that.
I can only watch one episode. I rewatch one episode. That's episode 7, Double Vision. For some reason, that one is still fairly compelling to me. And even the dub, like, they've gotten a little better by that point, so it's watchable in English. But it's, yeah, the whole show just hasn't aged all that well for me.
It's the 80s. It's the look, the sound, the feel, the future, as they would say in the Gaga Communications Reel demo, where it was called Futurescape.
Right.
But yeah, my favorite episode was the sixth episode, because that's, you know, that's peak Masami Obari, man.
Yeah, I was in an FYE the other day, and there it was, that absolutely hideous, glittering pink, like neon pink packaging that they put it in. Ugh. God, that thing was ugly.
I think BGC kind of inherited the aesthetic of Megazone 2-3 Part 1.
Yeah.
It was very easy to make the leap from that one to the next. And, of course, both of them owe their existence to Streets of Fire, which we all
right.
know.
Right.
For me, I saw most of the BGCs, but it was kind of the same problem I had with Urusei Yatsura. Too many Psycho fans too early in its life, and there were other things that interested me more, so I moved on.
Yeah, this one was absolutely crammed down my throat by the old timers in the anime club, and I grew to resent it as a result. And if I, frankly, like to this day, I have still heard those awful songs like 10 times too many. It's just, Jesus.
I think maybe because I sought it out of my own accord and it wasn't forced on me, that's probably why I like it more and, you know, imported the CD soundtracks and all that stuff. I think if people were really insistent, I probably wouldn't like it the way that I do.
Well, I don't hate it. It's not terrible. You know, certainly something that gets that popular has something going for it. But I think it's a good lesson for everybody that you got to be careful how you present these things to other people, because you could end up having the opposite effect of what you want.
Okay. Other user lists, G Tebbets lists Mazenikoku, Bubblegum Crisis, Prefectural Earth Defense Force. And study of anime lists Zeta Gundam, Go Lion, and the Gyver.
Wow, Go Lion. I mean, most people, you know, I certainly grew up watching Voltron, unaware that it was anime. I purchased the Go Lion re-release once Media Blasters put it out. Great deal. You know, really surprisingly, a lot was edited out to make it Voltron. But yeah, I wouldn't put it as one of my tops. Like, it didn't even dawn on my mind to included on the top 10 list.
If he's talking about Gyver, the OVA, that started in late 89 and went through the 90s. So that was mostly a 90s show.
Yeah, I think of the Gyver as a 90s production.
And terrible.
Oh, well, there's a lot of support for the Gyver, but like Tim said with Saint Seiya, most all of that support is the tokusatsu community people. I don't see a whole lot of anime fans being that gung-ho about the Gyver. I will say I, you know, like the original OAV, and even the second OAV to some extent, but the TV series did not do it for me. And believe it or not, I do enjoy that second live action film, virtually a fan film. But yeah, it's definitely a tokusatsu realm.
Okay, so that takes us to number three, and this time let's go ahead and start with Justin.
Okay. My number three is one I've waxed philosophical about quite a bit, and that is Go Shogun, The Time It's Ranjae. Also released as Time Stranger, confusingly, because there's a Rintaro movie by that name.
which never came out here, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's actually very similar to Dagger of Kamui, both feel-wise and, you know, epic-wise. But anyway, Goshogun the Time of Tranjay, for those who don't know about it, is a final movie to a big connecting giant robot show, but has no giant robots. Actually, it just takes the characters, ages them into old people, and makes the whole thing into this kind of Bergman-esque art film, which is kind of just examines the trajectory of roles and a person's life and how it interconnects with their friends. And it's really, really gorgeous. It has some really interesting and kind of damning things to say about Islamic extremism. And I don't know of any anime that feels like this. Or I'm kind of out of things to say about it, to be honest. But I've written so much about this and I've talked so much about this, but I love it so much. And it's just a great film.
Agreed.
I'm just fascinated that they made that from its source material. I can never wrap my mind around how they got this film from that TV show.
Yeah, it makes no sense. I've only seen a little, like a couple scenes of that TV show, and it's a very, you know, kind of its era TV show. It's not particularly noteworthy. But this movie, it stands alone, and it's just kind of this great meditation on the story of someone's life.
Yeah, it's also a really interesting kind of deconstruction of the whole super robot mythos, in that you could take something from that genre and turn it into something completely different and disconnect it to that degree. I liken it to Watchmen myself, the way Alan Moore deconstructed superhero comics.
Right. Now that we're living in an era where the word deconstruction barely means anything anymore, it actually applies to this.
Yes.
as a term. I meant to get around to rewatching this one. I have seen it. I remember it being a very special and unique, and no one else in Anime Club liked it, and most people walked out of it, but I was pretty captivated by it, I remember. And I will revisit it someday. But it's definitely standout. It's one of those things that I could totally see Criterion releasing that if they were aware of it. You know?
Right.
There must have been no consequence whatsoever to taking Goshogun and completely throwing it out and, you know, replacing it with this film, which was a zillion times better than its source material. It would be a really interesting story to explore if nobody's done it yet.
Yeah, no one's ever really done a good interview with Kunihiko Uyama, and God, that guy was so all over the place and doing so many interesting things in the 80s, and until the last 15 years he's just been marinating in Pokemon. I mean, maybe that's kind of animator retirement. I'm just going to work on something mindless and repetitive for the next, you know, 20 years.
Don't tell me that I just finished a Scooby-Doo job.
No comment.
All right. So, Daryl, what's your number three?
Gotta be me, man. You all knew it was coming. No, this was actually a toss-up between two films, but if I had to pick one, I noticed that there really needed to be some representation of Osamu Dezaki, so I picked his most stylistically out there film he's ever done, and that's The Professional, Go-Go 13, which is not a movie that anime fans like. But, you know, Dezaki, and you know, not just that film, but Go-Go 13 in general, not really something that's typically popular. It's a comic that's made for 50-year-old men. Don't really see too many of at anime conventions. But this film, I know a lot of people, whenever you mention it, it kind of gets reduced down to two words: CG helicopter. Yeah, it looks bad, but it's also demonstrative of the risks that this film was willing to take in terms of experimentation, animation techniques, cinematography, camera angles, you name it. This was a pretty, you know, spectacular movie in terms of all the things that it tried to do. And it didn't have to be this weird. They could have done a very safe bet. The comic that it's derived from is very cut and dry, very static, very, you know, procedural and like mechanical in how it, you know, plays about, how it's made. This film is wild and crazy and weird. certainly, you know, earlier discussions were talking about, you know, the excesses of the 80s. You know, the professional Golgo 13, you know, embodies it all. This is a movie where there's roughly, you know, one murder and one sex scene every, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, and the movie is only 90 minutes long. But this is like one of those movies that when I saw it as a teenager, I didn't actually like this movie at all. It wasn't until much later that I went back that I could kind of appreciate, you know, what went into the, you know, filming of it, the craft. But even then, I know a lot of people who watch this movie in their 20s and such, and they're like, yeah, what do people see in this movie? I was struggling whether or not I should put this one on or Space Adventure Cobra the movie, which is also a great, terrific Osamu Dezaki film that's about to get re-released from Discotech. But since they also are re-releasing The Professional, you can have both. I think that of all the things to kind of like say, like, what's the big deal about this character? Why has he endured for, you know, 40 some years? Even though the film has it's not adapted from any prior story, it's written originally for animation. I think this kind of encapsulates like what's going on with Golgo 13. Yeah, he shoots people and he sleeps with the ladies and he doesn't change his facial expression. But it's so out there and crazy that it could never be made, you know, a film like this anyway, any other time but the 80s. It's the only movie that we ever got. It would be, you know, a decade and change later before we got another anime in terms of an OAV, and then another decade and change before we got a TV show. And, now there's probably not going to be any more for, you know, on the horizon. We'll probably have to wait another 10, 15 years, but, people, this movie gets released and re-released time and again. There's something to it. Whether or not it's for anime fans is, you know, questionable.
You know, you really hit the nail on the head when it comes to the charm of Dezaki, because, you know, he was very hit and miss. Even during his heyday, he was very hit and miss as far as, like, what worked and what didn't. But he was so baldly experimental and was so unafraid of taking risks that, and half the time it really paid off. And I think The Professional is one of those where either you love it or you hate it, because it's so ultra violent and so sexual, and you know, that just that whole ugly look of it doesn't appeal to a lot of people. But it really does, those stylistic touches aside, it really does encapsulate what Dezaki was willing to do to make something interesting.
It's the kind of movie that elicits, for most people, maybe not all of us here, a strong reaction. You either, like, you know, really like it or really don't like it at all. And I think that's just because Dezaki, in general, just didn't know how to be average.
No.
Yeah, I watched this last week, and the experience was, it felt like I was chain-smoking a pack of unfiltered cigarettes from 1982. Like,
Golgo 13 smokes parliaments.
Yeah. Man, it's an ugly-ass movie. Like, it's the ugly version of Cosmopolitan. So you'll have, like, all the women in it have that 1980s dancer's body that I guess was supposed to be, like, the super attractive thing back then. And
I still like those.
Yeah, well, and you know, lots of leotards.
I'm still down for it.
And boats and you know, sailboats that kind of look junky, and lots of sort of you know, late 70s Baroque kind of gold trim on things, and it's a fucking ugly movie. But
do you mean to say that it's animated or drawn badly? Because I think that, you know, there's exquisite detail put
into. No, don't get me wrong. I don't think that it is. When I say ugly, like, that's a result of the production design. The production itself is quality. It's nicely animated for what it is. But it's so rooted in, like, this kind of, hey, here's an alley in San Francisco in 1976. Let's make our whole movie look like this. It's just gritty. It's grim. It's gritty and dirty and gross. And that's intentional, I'm sure.
Everything in it is either crusty or smelly.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. That is the feeling I got from it. I'm glad I saw it. But yeah, it's not anyone surprised that this is really high on Daryl's list. No.
Daryl, do you think it's accurate to say that Golgo 13 is not really a character, but
a force of nature?
Either a force of nature or a cipher or a symbol or something, because I think what keeps turning people off to him is they're looking for him to have a personality, and he most assuredly does not. I mean, he's anti-hero all the way. He's anti-personality all the way. He is a machine. And the more you look for something in him that you can relate to and respond to, the more frustrated you're going to get. So I think the key is not to look for that.
And I think Golgo 13, in a lot of ways, we know more about what Golgo 13 does than almost any other anime character. I can tell you where he prefers to stand when he walks into a room. I can tell you exactly like why he does the things he does. Well, let me rephrase that. I can tell you the methods by which he does the things he does. What I can't tell you is what's going on between those ears. Why does he do the things that he does? We know what in exquisite detail from decades and decades that, okay, this particular, you know, fashion, this particular liquor, these cigarettes, you know, I always have my back to the wall in this situation. I don't shake hands, all that stuff, all these rules and things that he abides by. But if you want to know, like, where did this guy come from? Why does he do the things that he does? He may as well be the Joker, because you're not going to get an answer that's definitive ever. He's purely, you know, in that sense, much like the way the Batman villain, the Joker, represents chaos. You know, Golgo 13 is sort of this transcendental figure that he's above everything. He's above society. You know, there's no like chance that he's going to fail. You know, he's going to kill his target unerringly. The draw is how, as opposed to why. And between that and the fact that there is no continuity, a lot of American fans of anime strongly prefer serialization. Like, they look at the lack of serialization as, you know, maybe a conceit of mostly American, you know, entertainment, like sitcoms and the like, that's starting to change in recent years. But yeah, I mean, if people want to know, like, we don't even know Golgo 13's real name. You know, Duke Togo's an alias. We don't know his nationality. People think he might be Japanese. You know, everything about where he came from is a total mystery. And so that is one of the things that kind of keeps people from getting into anime, especially now when what people want from their narratives is tell, don't show. They want like someone to stand still and say, I was born in so-and-so situation, and then this happened to me, and ever since that day, I have decided to do this, and you're not getting that from Golgo 13, brother. So yeah, I can see why it's always been a thing that turned away a lot of anime fans, but there's something about this movie in particular that keeps people coming back. And Jason Thompson, when he wrote his House of 1000 manga on Golgo 13, said a big thing that turns away people is just the ugliness of the artwork. You know, it's certainly by design, but it is something that, you know, it's not a glamorous sort of world that Duke Togo operates in, even if he drives like the fanciest car and drinks the finest liquor and all that stuff.
Okay. Golgo 13. All right. That brings us, Tim, to your number three.
My number three is another TV series from 1985 called Blue Meteor SPT Lasner. And it was made by Ryusuke Takahashi, whose name came up earlier when I talked about Panzer World Galliant. Galliant was the show that came before Lasner. And Lasner was essentially his take on Mobile Suit Gundam, but of course what Takahashi became famous for was putting his own spin on it, moving it into a new direction, and making the whole greater than the sum of the parts. It's another hard science fiction show. It opens on the planet Mars, and there is another alien invasion, very different from the one in Galliant. This one is aimed for Earth, and it is completely unstoppable, and there's a rebel pilot who abandons his army to warn the people of Earth that it's coming. And it takes place in the year 1996, which is a little
bit the far future.
Yeah. And so, you know, just like when you watch every movie from the 80s that talked about how far ahead we would be in the 90s and the aughts, it's a little depressing. But that said, this is a very high octane action show with some very interesting design. The director was Moriyasu Taniguchi, who came out of Armored Trooper Votums and other things. And in the way that Giant Gorg was everything Yasuhiko could do, SBT Lasner represents everything Taniguchi could do. The action sequences are extremely fast and extremely energetic. It's got some, and this is a purely technical note, it's got some timing techniques that I've not seen again in probably two decades. They're starting to come back now, but it was way ahead of its time just in terms of how you kinetically present an action sequence with robots and energy. It's a little bit of a turnoff because the story was supposed to be longer, and the first arc lasts 24 episodes, and to be honest, it could have been done faster. It could have been done easily in 13, but I'm grateful for the 24 because it just gives me more of what I like to enjoy. The second arc was meant to be the same length, but it got cut short by low ratings toward the end, so it only ended up being about 36, 37 episodes, and then Noe V had to come in and fill in the gap later because they literally jumped from second to the last episode over a whole bunch of story material right into the finale. So if you don't get that OAV, you're going to miss something. Another thing that's interesting about the second arc is that stylistically it borrows from a whole different creative well than the first part. I think Gundam was the creation source of the first part, and Fist of the North Star was actually the creation source for the second part. So it adds a whole new dynamic. It mixes two very different genres of anime into one, and the drama and the cliffhangers go into a high register in that second arc. Every episode is just either a tearjerker or it makes you want to leap out of your chair. It's really exciting, a lot of fun to watch, and it also is one that has come close to import a few times, but is regrettably still on the wrong side of the wall. But there may be a fan sub out there to help that out. I've not seen one myself. I hope there is.
The first arc has been completed as of maybe only a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, it's just that. I never actually got a chance to see SBT Lasner, you know, very much of it. I maybe saw a couple episodes of Raw several years ago before anyone thought to subtitle it. And it's, you know, there were just other things to watch, and it's hard to get into when you're, you know, 14 or 15 or whatever. But it is one that's always fascinated me. And yeah, as far as I can tell, it was just very inaccessible. It's not, when I say inaccessible, I mean because it was never released here.
Right.
And by the time I came around, people were basically, you know, expectant that the anime that they watch have some sort of translation, which, you know, very few people will watch unsubtitled anime in the modern era. So, yeah, there is, I believe that entire first arc, the first 24 are now, you know, one guy, I believe, the same guy who, you know, almost single-handedly, I think, did Dugrum and, you know, Galliant and all that stuff is going through Lasner. He's just going through them. You know, that whole Ryosuke Takahashi mid-80s Real Robot era of cartoons that, you know, for so many years have been spoken about in like hushed tones. It's like, oh, this is the cool deal. Now it's finally starting to trickle out there. I think in a couple of years more people will see it. The thing is that right now we're in a state where the mecha fans have kind of already made up their mind, and the people who aren't mecha fans have already made up their mind, like, I don't need to watch that. I got so much other stuff that doesn't have robots that it's probably only going to be known among the faithful at this point, because it's obscure even for me, and I consider myself fairly knowledgeable.
Right.
I haven't seen this, but I remember being really, really impressed by the opening.
Yeah, it's got some cool music. It's got great opening songs. And I got to say this again, when it makes the shift from arc one to arc two, there's a jump forward in time of 3 years. It goes from 1996 to 1999. Of course, those numbers are completely apocryphal now. But in that time, when the characters are off camera, there is a gigantic shift in the world structure and the power structure. And when you come back, that first episode just breaks your heart. And I have never made it through the end of that episode with dry eyes. It gets me every time.
Cool. All right. Okay, so that brings us to my number three, which I had not seen until recently, and was pretty blown away by it. It's another Dazaki. This would be the 1982 Space Adventure Cobra film.
Good pick.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a fucking fantastic movie, and I was resistant to Cobra because so much
because Gerald keeps talking about it.
Well, not so much that, but it's lumped in with the 80s hyper masculine stuff that, frankly, at this point, I feel has been talked up too much. If I ever got to hear about Mad Bull 34 again, I'm going to throw something through a window.
That's the 90s, Zach.
But in the 80s,
you know what? Your boy Dave from Astro Toy is the real Mad Bull advocate. I haven't said a word about that in years.
Okay, but do you understand the premise that I am floating here? That this stuff is talked about, especially like the people I tend to hire to write for me, the writers I tend to read, the people I tend to listen to. This stuff is just okay enough with the 80s hyper-masculine stuff. And so I sort of lumped Cobra in with that, and I never really was drawn to like any of the TV series or the OVAs. But I thought, you know what, I should watch that. And the amount of Dazaki stuff that I have seen is pretty low, so let's watch this. And I was blown away. Not necessarily so much by the story, although the story is kind of neat. But visually, this thing is amazing. It's amazing. It is the purest distillation of someone taking 80s era, late 70s, early 80s era futurist painting, like science fiction painting. People who would draw these futurescapes, and you know, it'd be like you'd have like a rocky surface and a cloud and a sky with clouds, and then there's three like monoliths that are reflecting the clouds. You know, that kind of artwork. He just made that into a movie, and to the point where oftentimes the film. Nothing's happening in the story. He's just trying some shit out on screen with the animation. And you could take any frame of that film, any frame, take it out and turn it into an album cover for like Electric Light Orchestra or like Boston. You know, I mean, it's that close to that kind of animation. And I always thought to myself, because I love that kind of artwork. It's so evocative of a particular time and place in creativity and imagination that it's always like, why didn't anyone ever just animate that? And oh, they did, and it's this movie. it's phenomenal. Even the villain, this incredibly crazy, creepy looking villain, it's got a clear body and you can see his golden skeleton beneath it, and it is fantastically effective. I mean, like I said, the story is what it is. The lead character Cobra is kind of a Lupin, sort of a little bit of a womanizer, sort of a Han Solo type, and he's not that much going on with his character, but overall, just everything in it is so creatively clear and interesting to look at and fascinating, and I was very taken with it. I really enjoyed it. I really want a Blu-ray.
Yeah, they're saying that that may be possible since Cobra is about to be re-released very soon. I'm actually writing an article on Cobra right now, which is more different than the article I wrote 2 years ago on Cobra, which is still on the Otaku USA website. I stand by it. But yeah, I think they've said that that is possible if the DVD sales do well enough. And that's always, you know, a murky proposition for me because I'd end up invariably having to double dip. But yeah, it's a beautiful looking movie. If you like the film, the original TV series that Osamu Dezaki did is also great. Definitely worth your time. This film is sort of a compressed version of retelling of maybe the first couple episodes of that TV series. But yeah, it's a very imaginative series of a type of sci-fi that just you don't really see too often anymore. That sort of old pulp science fiction that kind of draws its era, that its influences from this era when people were thinking like, yeah, 1999 is going to have the flying cars and the jetpacks and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's very Mobius influenced, isn't it?
Yeah, you could tell. Yeah,
there's a lot of and the rollicking, more kind of lightweight stuff. I kind of think of more along the lines of the TV show, but the movie is very kind of ethereal and experimental. It's just God, I just love sitting in it. It's one of those like kind of turn all the lights off, crank up the stereo, and just kind of escape to another world sort of films for me.
Yeah, and I to me, the brazenness of the, yeah, this doesn't have anything really to do with anything. I just want to try this shot. Like, it's brazen at times, and it's great. It's really great to see someone just get to creatively just put it all out there. And yeah, I loved it, and it's it would probably be higher if my number one and two didn't have to be my number one and two. But yeah, fantastic stuff. Really glad I discovered it, and yeah, looking forward to seeing what else there is of Cobra. Although I doubt any of it is as good, I will check it out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Dazaki wasn't, he was still alive, but when they made the new Cobra animations, they're not as, avant-garde in the cinematography, but in terms of the spirit of it is still intact. Like, they, even got a lot of those original voice actors from, 20, 30 years ago to reprise their roles.
Wow. Cool. All right. Use your list for number three. Sui RT, Yuri Yatsura, Legend of the Galactic Heroes, and Dirty Pair.
It's fascinating how often Legend of the Galactic Heroes is getting mentioned. It's given that its relative lack of popularity now, overall.
These are people that listen to this show.
That is true.
Well, I, for one, appreciate their willingness to stick it out.
Yeah.
I think endurance makes you, it puts you into an elite category of anime viewer. Especially if you go over 100 episodes. That earns a merit badge in my book.
Exceptionally good.
Yeah, from what I've seen about half of it at this point, and the act of sitting through Gundam kind of made me realize, like, oh, this is kind of like Legend of the Galactic Heroes, except with not as much of the stuff that I like in it. Like, it doesn't have that. I like all the political stuff, and it's there in Gundam, but not to the extent.
It's just never pulled off the way it should be in Gundam.
Right. Yep.
The political intrigue is unnecessarily complicated and thinks it's much smarter than it is in a lot of the, more contemporary productions. But
All right, Madu Homu Magica says Meizane Koku, Super Dimensional Fortress Macross, and Gunbuster, which I don't think we've had come up yet.
Yeah, Gunbuster is one of those eternal classics. I was never as huge a fan of Gunbuster as other people, but yeah, that first viewing is that sticks with you. It's a gut punch for Gunbuster. But yeah, I it's not one. If Tim uses repeatability as a key criteria, I don't feel that Gunbuster has enough repeatability in my book, with the exception of that fifth episode, which, I'm solid with.
Yeah,
I mean, the ending is way, way better than the rest of the show, in my opinion.
I agree. Okay, we're, the end is in sight, people. We're almost done here.
Five golden rings.
Further along than that. Okay, number two. Let's start with Daryl.
My number two pick is Area 88, the OAVs. This is by Kaoru and Shintani, former assistant to Leiji Matsumoto, sort of immortalized in anime as being Captain Harlock's first mate, who is a total otaku for model kits and planes and the like. Area 88 is about a gentleman by the name of Shin Kazuma, who is a civilian pilot who finds himself inadvertently conscripted to fight as a mercenary in a war in the Middle East, for which, as a mercenary, there's only three ways that he can sort of get out of there, and that's to get enough kills or serve a three-year contract. And so it's the kind of thing that is very rooted in its era. It's even though it was made in the 80s, it's set in the 70s, and you can tell because of the fashion and the designs. It combines the really meticulous attention to detail on the planes blowing up with this very sort of almost shoujo-like character design approach to its cast. This was the very first Japanese language English subtitled anime I ever saw. So that means that tape that I was given, the first thing on it was the double riding bean, and then episode one of Area 88 in Japanese. So what? Welcome to anime, Daryl. That was me. I think that as far as like the kind of story it's telling, it is incredibly melodramatic. I mean, we've been talking about things where people wouldn't act this way. It is definitely present in Area 88 as a conscientious decision, and my opinion towards that approach is that you either go for it all the way or don't go for it at all. If you try to do a little piecemeal thing, it's just going to be, you know, some sort of cheesy, you know, Star Wars prequel kind of thing. But this really caught my eye. One of the earliest OAVs ever made. I was like, from the very beginning, you see like attention to detail you'd never see in any modern production. Like the opening credits is just this flame burning, but it never loops. It never repeats itself. Somebody is drawing, you know, this detail that almost nobody is going to conscientiously pick out. They put in that much effort for it. It's definitely not the sort of story that you'd really see told. And certainly not in American animation. I mean, when I first started to see it, I was like, whoa, this is like a super violent G.I. Joe where they don't eject from the cockpits. But the themes that it discusses and it touches upon, you know, the desensitization to violence, you know, what it takes to, you know, survive out in these areas of the world where these conflicts take place. Certainly, you know, years later, I understood, oh, the reason why it's that way is so you could draw as many different types of cool planes as possible and have a reason for it to exist. Maybe the only way that people know about Area 88 in America is there was a video game for the Super Nintendo called the UN Squadron, which was, you know, just Area 88, what they called it here. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely rooted in that sort of nihilistic Vietnam War era period of the world. They did do a new TV series in the 2000s that didn't really get the chance that it deserved. It was, you know, not very high budget. That was kind of the nail in the coffin for that one.
You had a bunch of really janky CG.
Yeah, really early television quality CG that even when they quote-unquote cleaned it up for home video, still didn't look that great. Plus, they changed all the music. This is one, the original Area 88 OAVs soundtrack. I mean, we've gone this far, and we haven't even mentioned Mio once. This is very memorable, you know, in terms of not just visuals, not just storyline, but also in its audio. But yeah, if you want to talk about 80s, this is, you know, squarely 1985. I strongly recommend it. I know that it's been released onto DVD. The Japanese DVDs are slightly edited. I'm not sure why they sort of trimmed down one of the Vietnam era flashbacks, but that's the way to see this movie. I mean, these OAVs. And it's one of those things that's because maybe it's just me because of nostalgia and what made me a fan, but it's always going to be high up on any top 10 list that I ever make for anime. Even though I say that it'll change every 5 minutes, Area 88's always going to be on there.
Yay. You know,
when I was at CPM, we always joked that this was the show that we couldn't pay anyone to take from us. And then ADV did.
Okay. All right. Area 88. Let's go with Tim next.
We're on number twos now, huh?
Yeah, number two.
Okay. Well, here's something that, boy, I really hope I'm not the only guy who's seen it. Galaxy Drifter Vifam.
Vifam, yeah. I didn't know it was called Galaxy Drifter Vifam, but I'm aware of what Vifam is.
Vernian Vifam, because that's the name that showed up on a lot of model kit boxes, and it's what they call their robots. You know, instead of mobile suits, they are round Vernians, and that refers to their propulsion technique.
According to Sunrise, that's the official English name.
Well, Sunrise can blow me sometimes. Every single thing I've got on Galaxy Drifter Vifam has Galaxy Drifter on it, so I prefer to stick with the army I go to war with. Anyway, Vifam was done in 1983, and it was not a product of Ryosuke Takahashi or Yoshiyuki Tomino. It was somebody else whose name I have yet to pin down because I haven't gotten that deep into this particular franchise yet. But I've watched the show over and over and over, and it's essentially Lost in Space, again with robots and with war. And the difference is that the main characters are all children, aged from about 4 years old up to about 16 years old. And they are stranded on a spaceship, and they have to try and figure out how to get home. But instead of going home, they go right into the thick of it. And every one of these children is a unique character. There are no two that are alike. They all have their own unique traits and their own contributions to make to the story. And at times they play it for humor. The animation director for the series was Toyo Ashida, who's got a strong comedy background.
And Fist of the North Star.
Yeah. The comedy never takes over, though. It's always perfectly balanced with the drama. And so when there are moments of genuine emotion, you feel them right along with the characters. You don't feel like you're being played to. There's nothing fake about it at all. And everything you want these kids to do. They go through everything you want this story to go through on your behalf. And so it's very easy to emotionally connect with it. It originally ran 46 episodes and a handful of OAVs that plug into it, including an epilogue. And then about 10 years later, there was a follow-up series called Vifom 13 that was 26 episodes long. Some people consider it a remake, but it's actually an extension. There's a break in the story halfway through the original series. Vifom 13 fits right in the middle of that break. Technically, that makes it filler, but it's still fun filler. And so if you're like me and you want as much of this series as you can possibly get, that's a good thing. It doesn't get a lot of play today because it was never officially imported, although it has been fan-subbed, and I helped to get that done, so I highly recommend it. And it also is one of those that came and went in terms of merchandising. It does sort of perennially come back. The latest trip I took to Japan was about a month ago, and there were some reissues in the model kit shelves, so it's always nice to see that occasionally make a comeback. It's become kind of one of Sunrise's crown jewels from the 80s because within the genre that it fits into, which is the real robot, it's entirely unique. You cannot say it's derived from any other show. It has its own original voice, and the only thing that ever tried to go there in recent years was Infinite Rivius, however you want to pronounce it, and that was merely an echo. Vifom is the real thing, and I hope everyone will make the effort to track down that fan sub because it's awesome.
Cool. I'll have to look it up. I've never even heard of it.
I've heard of it, but it's one of those giant pile of 80s mecha shows that if you're just thumbing through the catalogs doesn't really stand out in any way. So knowing that it's something that's worth checking out, you know.
Well, as with all things, it's the writing that keeps you coming back. That's what gives it a shelf life. And the writing on this is top notch. That's why it's number two on my list. So wait till I get to number one.
There's no doubt in my mind what the number one you've yet to mention is, but...
All right, so Justin, we're down to your number two.
All right, my number two is actually a little bit of a repeat. It's a Space Adventure Cobra movie.
Yeah, all right, okay.
But it's not the, I want to specify that it is the now very obscure UK dub, which had all of the music ripped out and replaced with the music of 80s electro band Yellow.
Yeah, wow. I only was aware of Yellow because of, like, Twix commercials.
Right, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Right, that's how I know about Yellow. And, you know, when they ran that trailer, I'm like, are they just running this music? And it's like, nope, that's what they replaced the soundtrack with. And to this day, whenever news of a Cobra movie release comes out, the first thing I always hear is people saying, does it have the UK dub that Japan was unaware existed?
Yeah,
thus far, the answer's always been no.
Yeah, and it never will because Cobra's Cobra's has a very particular creator, and so I don't think they want to tell him that the music has been ripped out and replaced. So I don't think this will ever see the light of day ever again. However, this music helps the ethereal mood of the show so much. There is a streamlined dub of the show as well. It kind of misses the mark. It makes Cobra a little too hard-edged. Cobra, when you stand back and think about it, he seems like the sort of guy that Brits would get. I like to describe him as a good bloke, you know, where he's very manly, but at the same time kind of goofy and likable and, you know, will just kind of goof around until he gets what he wants. And the UK dub really gets that. But this music, I mean, the original Cobra opening theme, for example, is an Enka song. And call me crazy, I don't think space and future and etherealness when I think about Enka music.
Yeah, it did seem out of place.
Right. And Yellow was just kind of the perfect kind of new agey sort of thing. And this was already the 90s. And so their music had kind of moved beyond the very sampled, crappy sounding 80s synth and had now just, it sounds not dated at all if you listen to it today.
Is there any way for people to get that version of it?
The French DVD apparently didn't, someone wasn't talking to somebody, and so it's on there. Selbia Discotheque has said that he's going to try to clear the rights for his re-release, but I don't think he's going to be successful. So we'll wait it out. We'll see if he can get it, but I have a feeling that you're going to have to just track down that French DVD or resort to the internet.
Well, wait, do you have it?
Yes, of course.
Well, then I'll be asking for a copy.
You bet. I've actually made myself a Blu-ray of it.
That sounds really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice, and it's my preferred way of watching that movie.
Yeah, cool.
I think maybe now that you mentioned that aspect, that might explain why one of my also-rans on my top 10 was Goku Midnight Eye, just because it's also made by the guy who made Cobra, Buichi Terasawa, and it's a collaboration of that plus Yoshiaki Kawajiri, and so I think maybe it was a representative pick that I ultimately didn't go with for my top 10.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so that's number two, and our user lists, second to last, Manime Podcast, List Crusher Joe, Dirty Pair Project Eden, and Venus Wars.
Wow, that's a Yoshikazu Yasuhiko, triple threat.
That trick.
Triple play, yeah.
Yeah. No, I Project Eden is, super cool, and so is Crusher Joe. Both of those were also, in my contentions.
I love Crusher Joe. Project Eden, I will watch that opening sequence, that ridiculous Koji Morimoto just being insane animator genius. I'll watch that over and over and over again, and I really pray to God that comes out on Blu-ray at some point anywhere. I will buy it.
Wait, I just realized I forgot to list my number two.
Oh.
My brain's getting shaken up here.
We've been doing this a while now.
3.5 hours. Okay. My number two is Akira. The only thing I'll say about this that hasn't been said is that I have appreciated this more and more as time has gone on, and I am a much bigger fan of it now than I was when I first saw it, and even for years afterward. It's grown on me considerably. I think it's a great action movie. It's a great piece of science fiction. And that whole "it doesn't make any sense" thing is testament to how just shitty that original script was, because now it makes sense. If you watch it, it's fine. Totally makes sense. It's not that confused. It's not really confusing at all. They pretty much lay it out for you. And just as a beautiful film that has held up really, really well over the years, and it continues to be a great, great piece of animation that it's not at all a bad thing if someone thinks Akira when they think about anime. It's a fantastic film that will live on forever, I'm sure. So yeah, Akira, number two. All right, moving on. Let's get to the other user lists. The Rinzo list, they were 11. Project Aiko and Akira, and then Zeruda, your friend and mine, Daniel Zelter, lists Akira, Gunbuster, and Totoro. Okay. So here we are at the end of all things. We're at number one. And let us start. Actually, before we do our number ones, I'm going to read the last of our user lists. And these would be the people that sent us our list that I would have invited them all to be on the show if we had enough space for them. But Helen McCarthy sent in her list, and it's My Neighbor Totoro, Grave of the Fireflies, and Akira. She also put Macross TV, Pat Labor, and Dirty Pair. Adam Sheehan at Funimation sent in Akira, Nausicaa, and Vampire Hunter D, as well as Ron Moore and Half, Macross, and Maison and Coco. A lot of these guys split it into movies and TV. And Mike Toole listed Votoms, Macross, Maison Ikkoku, and Akira, Totoro, Beautiful Dreamer, and Gerald Rathcobe, the co-host of Daryl's podcast, listed Project Aiko, Nausicaa, and Do You Remember Love? All right, so let's get to our number ones, folks. Let's start with Tim.
Yay! Well, Mike Toole.
I'm in such suspense. I'm in such suspense. What could Tim possibly have said his number one? What is he so known for?
You know, it's MD Geist.
Yep, that's what it is.
Wait,
all
no, right. Odin. No, wait. All right, well, nobody will be surprised at all to hear me say the words Armored Trooper Votums.
Right, yep. We all knew that was coming.
And that's all of it, except for the most recent stuff, which kind of went off the rails. But the original 52-episode TV series plus the spinoff OAVs up to the mid-90s, everything after that is questionable. But the reason I love it so much is because if I could be in anime and making anime, it is the anime that I would make just for myself. It's got everything I like all in one place in terms of hard science fiction. And when I first saw it in the mid-80s, I identified very strongly with the characters and the writing and the style, and it just it seemed to borrow from everything I liked. There was a little bit of all of my favorite movies in it. And what made it more personal is that because it wasn't translated and because I had access to absolutely nothing in English, I had to work it out for myself what this show was about. And that was done over a very long period of time by watching episodes, comparing notes visually and conceptually, trying to figure out, well, if this is happening later in the episode, that means it was tipped off here and I was able to make connections that way. And in doing that as an exercise in sort of archaeology, I learned a hell of a lot about writing. And for that, I have to thank Ryosuke Takahashi for creating exactly as he did. I hope I get to meet the guy someday before he goes the way of my other anime idols, just so I can say thank you. But I think the greatest thank you I could have given him was to tip off a whole lot of people about the show and get Central Park Media to import it. For that, I'm still very, very proud, and I hope I've been able in a small way to bring as much joy and entertainment to others as Votums has brought to me.
Oh, okay. An impassioned case for Armored Trooper Votums. It's something.
Yeah, the only reason I didn't mention it is because I knew you'd be here, Tim.
Yeah, I really like the show. Although I will say after the what's the second arc called? Yeah, is that God Planet Quent?
The second arc is the Cuman Jungle Wars.
Jungle Wars.
Right. After the end of Cuman Jungle Wars, I struggled a little bit to stay with it. It gets a little saggy in the middle. I thought.
Just like all of us.
Ba-dum-bum.
All right. Okay, so Daryl, you're number one.
Sure. My number one is directed by Mr. Noboru Ishiguro, for whom this podcast is dedicated to. And it's Macross, Do You Remember Love? Very common pick among the users who've written in. And I think what would warrant saying about this, I could certainly go on for hours about it, and I have in the past, if you listen to show 50 of my own podcast 5 years ago. But to keep things succinct as to why does this film continue to come up again and again and again on so many lists, is that you can go back and forth as far as what best encapsulates the look of 1980s anime, but I believe that Do You Remember Love, more than any other single film, encompasses the spirit of what anime meant to people in the 1980s. Look, not just looking back, but at the time. I think that there's a lot of sincerity, a lot of blood and sweat and tears that went into every frame of this movie. I think certainly maybe I'm just nostalgic for it. I mean, I actually never saw it growing up. I didn't get to see it until I was trading tapes. But I did grow up on Robotech, and so maybe I was always preconditioned to enjoying something about Macross. And then the second I could get Japanese copies of Macross, there was no more need for Robotech. But yeah, I mean, in terms of what makes Macross work, you've got the spectacular animation, you've got jet planes flying in space, firing a billion missiles, and that tremendous Ichiro Itano animation sequences. But you also have, you know, what's obviously now I can see as a divisive element. But, you know, that was one of the things that captivated me about the film is the sheer melodramatic, elevated, you know, what's considered cheesiness now of the story, of the characterization. I think, you know, if there are, you know, black points of the movie as far as what it represents, you know, as far as Japanese mindsets, I don't think that it was, you know, an explicit effort so much as something that just, you know, shines through. And actually, believe it or not, until this podcast, I've never actually heard the argument put forth that it's a massively sexist movie. And I hang around some pretty militant feminists. But I can accept that, even if that is true. I think that Do You Remember Love is sort of like this holy grail of anime just because it was a thing to seek out. And it remains that just because of the fact that it's never been released in the United States, short of like the best video and Just for Kids celebrity VHS editions. And ever since, there's no US DVD. There is no Blu-ray. You know, the Japanese 30th year anniversary is about to come out. And the question on everybody's mind, does it have English subtitles? And obviously the answer is going to be no. But, you know, the reason why everybody wants to know is because that's one of the few things, like, you know, I'd count on one hand, the few things I would spend that exorbitant Japanese otaku fan money to procure would be this film. It means a lot to a lot of people. There's something magical about it. Doesn't look like, you know, anime looks now. Doesn't sound certainly like anime looks now. It's unique. And I think that's why it's just dominating so many lists of so many people who keep on writing in. And I'm with you guys all the way. It's my number one. If ever I have to rank things in top 10, when you guys told me it had to be a ranked list, you know, this was my first one on the list, no questions asked.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's the reason so many people love it. I mean, my objections to it come as a result of seeing it as a 32-year-old after being an anime fan for, you know, 15 years or whatever. I'm not looking at it with anything other than what is this now, not what does it represent or what did it used to be or whatever. And I think that perspective doesn't really do it much good. But I can't help but look at it that way, I guess. I don't know. Okay. All right. So I'll do my number one. My number one is Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. In a surprise to no one, that is my number one. The reason that I like that movie so much, and I obviously the comics are better. It's a lot better, actually. The story's a lot better. The movie has a certain magic to it that, to me, encapsulates the 80s and what was possible then and what people were doing then, the kind of fantasy then, just the artwork, the way the landscapes look, the way the characters look, the way they're animated, the color palette that's used. It's intrinsically 80s, and there is sort of a magic to it. There's a sparkle to it that is encapsulated there better than anything else for me. And a lot of it has to do with the opening titles and the way the story goes. It is a real masterpiece, thematically, emotionally, visually. It's everything that I think of when I think about my favorite stuff from that era. Nausicaä is easily number one.
There aren't really too many other things that look like Nausicaä or have that kind of ethereal, you know, synthesizer soundtrack.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other things. Like, what's kind of like Nausicaä? And I'm kind of drawing a blank.
It is a vague idea of what illustration looked like then, what fantasy illustration looked like at that point in time.
Right. Kind of blobby, soft-edged.
Yeah.
Sort of. And, you know, even though it was very synth-heavy, it was actually far less synth-sounding than Laputa.
Yeah.
Which was so bad, Disney decided to redo it. Yeah.
There's something else I could say about Nausicaä, since we're kind of coming around to a full circle here. The farther back you go in anime, the more hand-drawn everything is. And I don't mean hand-drawn in the obvious way, but also in the warm, human, and attainable way, where you look at a series of drawings, you identify them as drawings, and yet they still elevate you, and they create a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. And the reason I bring that up is because that has been lost over the last decade in a major way. A lot of anime now is either enhanced or completely digital. And something else that that's interesting about that is that Miyazaki has always resisted going digital, but he's also upped his game with every single movie that came after Nausicaä. And so as you proceed through the Ghibli catalog, the movies become more and more about art, and I think less attainable if you're looking at it as an artist, because you see many, many different craftsmen bringing their work to the table and advancing the technology and the art form. But if you go backward in history, Nausicaä is kind of a pivot point where you can still see that everything is hand-drawn. It doesn't take any magic away from it, but I think that's why it's still scored over all the other Ghibli movies for me as an artist, because I look at that and I know how it's done, and yet that adds to the magic instead of taking away from it. That's a viewpoint I don't hear very often. I just wanted to put it out there.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a giant contributing factor to that film's impact on me, is that it is undeniably handmade.
Mm-hmm.
It is a handmade work that was created by artisans working with a set of tools that had been around for, you know, 40 or 50 years at that point. And it's that element of its production is incredibly vital to how it plays and how it makes you feel emotionally. It's a very specific thing. It's very specific. But let's conclude then with Justin, your number one.
My number one will surprise no one. We teased earlier. It is Touch.
All right. Okay.
Which I actually have not seen the movie versions beyond like taking a quick look at them to see, oh, the animation's different. But I actually sat through all 101 episodes, and I will happily do that again. It is that I didn't come to Touch until just a few years ago, and it's not the most accessible show in the world. It's really long, never released here for obvious reasons. It's old, it's sports, it's long. You know, American anime fans are well known for their complete dismissal of sports anime, unfortunately. But man, is this show good. And most of it comes down to the character writing. The characters are just so indelible and likable and relatable that you don't really care that their interests and obsessions and life experience don't line up much with your own. I mean, certainly in my case, I'm no jock. But to the point where the last arc of the show is mostly just watching baseball games, and they're so intense that even as someone who, if you brought me to a real Major League Baseball game, I would probably hang myself by the fourth or fifth inning. I was edge of my seat, absolute edge of my seat, jumping up and down over baseball games played by people who don't exist and are just line art. And I, halfway through that experience, I just stopped for a second. I just went, holy crap, who am I? What have I become? And it's opened up other doors for me. I mean, Fighting Spirit, Hajime no Ippo, another sports anime that I've loved. More recently, Musashi no Ken and Initial D. These are shows that I would not have given a chance to, and they're not as good as Touch. Touch is the number one show that will always just be the most indelible, the most memorable, the most lovable sports anime ever. And it's really the story of a couple really nice kids' personal journeys. And that's what sports anime should be and what makes it so compelling.
Okay, yeah. It's,
well said.
Yeah.
My entire contact with Touch is watching somebody perform the opening theme on stage live, my first trip to Japan.
That's it?
Sounds like I better fix that.
Yes.
Start with
yes,
the movies, and then if you want to fill in the blanks, there's a whole world of TV for you. And I would just, dip lightly into that.
Well,
because
the thing is,
that is an investment.
It is. But, you know, the other thing is TV does such a great job of connecting you to characters simply by virtue of its length.
Yeah, you got to give it the time. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
you know, if you, you can't really do the modern era one episode test for touch.
No.
And say like, oh yeah, I'm gonna keep watching this or not. You know, that's a that is a slow burn for the TV show. I recommend the series without hesitation to people, even now. But I do say to do the movie is purely as a result of they'll know real fast whether it's for them or not if they watch just that first movie.
Right. That's a good point. And the TV show does move so slow that they're it takes advantage of that, where, you know, the first episode, they're kind of, you know, kiddish and blobby looking. But as the show progresses, you can see them, you know, their characters change as their bodies do because they're teenagers. And that's what happens. And so it's almost like, you know, it's like spending time with a 12-year-old versus spending time with a 17 or 18-year-old. It's a completely different person that you're hanging out with. And, you know, some people will just dismiss it as, oh, this show is about like these blobby kids, I can't relate. You will be able to, you know, there's, I would caution people against dismissing it too quickly, because what it turns into is nowhere near what it starts off as.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the art's going to be a barrier for a lot of people, but all you got to do is just give in to it. I was sold on it about, you know, 20 minutes into the first movie. I was like, okay, well, I can tell this is some quality storytelling, and the weird sort of monkey headed people didn't bug me. I got past that.
Yeah, I think for people who I know that are inclined to turn away from shows for reasons like that, I usually turn them to Cross Game first, just because it's a shorter show and you know, uses more modern animation techniques while keeping, you know, still roughly the same style of character design. You know, also, again, you know, really great, but it's not as good as Touch. That's not really a slight against something to say it's not as good as Touch.
Yeah, and frankly, like if you take all of our number ones and just watch them all, that is nearly like that's a really good cross section of what the 80s has to offer as a time period and for this particular art form. I think you'll get a decent little education if you just watch all of that stuff. But that about wraps it up, guys. Thank you so much for coming on and doing this. It is definitely a marathon session, but I think it was totally worth it. It was really great to hear your picks, and again, yeah, just can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you. I was really happy to take part in this. Makes me want to podcast more often. But in the meantime,
that can be arranged.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Good. In the meantime, once again, I'd like to suggest that if anybody's interested in seeing what's happening with the world of Space Battleship Yamato, especially the new series 2199, come on over to starblazers.com. There's already 10 tons of news there and more to be added soon.
Great. Okay.
And yeah, thanks for having me on once again. It's always a pleasure to be on with you guys and get on recording. It makes me wish I did it more often with my own podcast, but I'll take what I can get. Certainly, if you guys want to comment and say, hey, how dare you not mention this? I'll be in this forum comments thread watching it like a hawk. It's because, like I said, my picks will vary wildly depending on the mood that I'm in. If you want to hear more reviews of a lot of other 80s stuff, I tend to cover it a lot over at AnimeWorldOrder.com. And OtakuUSA Magazine.com also has a lot of retrospective features on things like Urusei Yatsura, Pat Labor, Space Adventure Cobra, a lot of things that we mentioned during these recordings. So thanks again, guys.
Okay, that wraps up our huge 80s show. Huge thanks to Tim and Daryl and Justin for all stopping on by and contributing to that. The theme song is Bucharest by the band New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a little rating or review while you're there. We'd really appreciate it. And we will see you all next week.